that shows up in your Twitter feed or on the evening news has already been tackled somewhere in literature. I'm Vivi Ganeshanandan, also known as Sugi, and the author of the novel Love Marriage.
And I'm Whitney Terrell, the author of the novel The Good Lieutenant. I can't believe that I'm going to ask this, but have you heard of the term fridging or fridged?
I have. The new Deadpool movie got a lot of flack for that. It's a comic book trope where the hero's love interest is killed off as a plot device right at the beginning of the story.
Oh, yeah. All right, look, I'm not even going to pretend that I actually know this, because this information comes from our producer intern, Aaron Saxon, who thought up this entire episode. But apparently, the term fridging dates back to an issue of Green Lantern where his girlfriend's body was found in a refrigerator, spurring him to seek revenge.
Ugh. It's crazy how often we see stories about murdered women. There are more and more specials like Making a Murderer and true crime podcasts like Serial are amazingly popular. It's so morbid, and yet people are obsessed. And there's even a true crime show hosted by Ice-T called In Ice Cold Blood.
And that's why we're so excited to talk to Alice Boland about her new book, Dead Girls, Essays on Surviving an American Obsession. Carmen Maria Machado has said, Dead Girls is everything I want in an essay collection. Provocative lines of inquiry, macabre humor, blistering intelligence. I love this book. Esquire has also called it one of the best nonfiction books of 2018 so far. Alice's collection takes a look at our culture's fascination with dead girls who seem to be everywhere, from true crime to noir to the most popular TV shows. Welcome to the show, Alice.
Thanks, guys, so much for having me.
And as a special treat, we also have another guest with us today. Kristen Martin's essays have appeared in Guernica, Bomb, and The Cut, among others. And she wrote for Literary Hub about Alice's book, so we thought there'd be no way to do this show without her. So she's joining us to talk about Dead Girls, and she's at work on her own collection of essays about grief. Welcome to the show, Kristen.
Thanks for having me.
It's really terrific to have you both with us at the same time today. Alice, in your book, you coined the phrase the Dead Girl Show. Everyone is, I think, at least a little bit familiar with the Dead Girl Show, Twin Peaks being maybe the most iconic. But can you describe what a Dead Girl Show is for our listeners?
Sure. Well, I think that a Dead Girl Show or a Dead Girl Story, they have existed for a long time. But I think especially with Twin Peaks, it's kind of this jump-started this trend, especially on TV, where the show starts with the discovery of the murdered body of a young girl. And the whole, you know, arc of the show is about solving her murder. And most often it's a pretty white teenager.
So that sort of trope, you know, shows up all over the place. And it's commonplace because there must be some reason why, you know, they want to have this as part of a story. And I also think people have forgotten to pay attention to the fact that this trope exists, you know. But I thought maybe you could sort of, and you do in your book, and Kristen also in her essay that she wrote about your book, sort of begin to unpack, like, what's under the surface of the story? Like, why does it exist? Why is it so appealing?
Right. I mean, I think that we understand the crime genres or thrillers or horror as being things that sort of talk about our, like, underlying fears or desires, you know, in some forbidden way. But at the same time, I think that we're also relatively resistant to sort of examining how those fears or desires play out in our own lives, like why we as educated people might want to seek out, you know, violent stories or stories about violence against women. And it's something I wanted to kind of make myself look at a little bit closer about why I was, you know, consuming true crime or, you know, mystery or detective stories, what I really got out of it.
I will say this, my wife will say this, friends of mine, both men and women will say, of these kinds of shows, like, I just don't want to think. I just want something that I don't have to think. You know, like, right. I want to just turn my mind off. Well, that's always, for me, a troubling, what are you turning your mind off about? You know?
Right. I always remember the writer, Anne Helen Peterson, who's, you know, she's an academic. She, you know, has her PhD in American studies, but then now she is a journalist and a critic of pop culture. And she said one time, she said, I think it was on Twitter, where people would tell her that she's overthinking things, you know, because she writes about People magazine or Julia Roberts or something. And she was saying, I know that if someone's telling me that I'm overthinking something, it means that I'm thinking the correct amount about
it. Right.
And they want me to be thinking about it not at all. And that she said, where I learned that was not from, you know, comment sections on, you know, BuzzFeed articles, but it was from academia, that people, that her colleagues would tell her that she was overthinking or overanalyzing some aspect of pop culture. And she was like, well, that's when I knew I'd hit upon a subject that was provocative or that I actually should be examining more thoroughly.
So speaking of like examining this trope thoroughly, which is something that you're definitely doing throughout all of the essays, in the first essay of the book, which is toward the theory of the dead girl show, you're talking about Grill Marcus's essay on Twin Peaks Picturing America. And he has a theory that the show appeals to the American psyche, so something really deep inside of us, and that we've inherited two major atrocities, slavery and the genocide of Native Americans, which seems to posit that there's something especially American about the dead girl trope. Would you agree with that?
I do agree with that. And that's actually one thing I really enjoy about the Marcus essay, is that he's not just thinking about Twin Peaks. He's thinking about the sort of all-American obsession with murder stories that goes back, you know, to Edgar Allan Poe or to murder ballads. And he's kind of making this point that underneath that kind of popular obsession and enjoyment of murder stories, there's this bigger murder story of, you know, a corrupt and violent country. And I feel like I can't disagree with that. I mean, I think it's obviously true. And I think that clearly the way that we treat women and marginalized groups says something about who we are as a people and about our values.
That makes me think a little bit about, I know that the Emmett Till case was just reopened, you know, the sort of notion, we had Matt Johnson on several episodes ago and talking about sort of crime fiction and how applicable that was to the ways that we read the news. And that seems to apply here as well a little bit, you know, sort of the notion that the violation of a woman is in a violation of the community and sort of, you know, here's the sanctity of the community and it has to be kept intact. And, you know, the history of lynching having so much to do with sort of the supposed violation of white women. So when you mention it, that's sort of what I think about our conversation with Matt and about Incognito and about the ways in which that detective story has to do with kind of holding up also not just sanctifying a certain kind of femininity, but also holding up a certain kind of masculinity. So ways that people have complicated this, like when there are women detectives, when the dead girl in question is not a white woman, something which I think that we're seeing more and more.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like that was one reason I wrote the kind of title essay in the book, I guess, in 2014. And I didn't sell the book until 3 years later. And one of the things I was trying to think about in that kind of intervening time when I was mulling over this idea was about how to make it about something more than just dead white girls, about the ways that that image is problematic for so many people within our society, the ways that it's been used not only to police women and to police white women, but to, you know, terrorize and oppress other groups of people, especially black men. I think that the Emmett Till case is the perfect example of that kind of white femininity being weaponized and, you know, leading to someone else's murder. I'm thinking in this book not only about those threats towards women, but the ways that women have been used as sort of weapons, or, you know, their white women's supposed, you know, sanctity is being used as weapons towards other marginalized groups.
That's also a thematic idea in the movie The Searchers with John Wayne. And speaking of the Native American half of this, that was the piece to show that I thought of when you started to talk about that in the book.
Yeah, I don't think it's a coincidence that Twin Peaks is, you know, this Western story that even borrows from those kind of Western genre elements,
absolutely,
including this sort of cartoonish portrayal of a Native American as this kind of deputy. Of course, that story is also about race, in addition to being about, you know, gender and sexual crime.
So, Alice, I wonder if you could read a little from one of the essays just to introduce your book to our listeners.
Absolutely. Alrighty, I'm reading from this essay called The Husband Did It. It's always the husband. Just watch Dateline, Gillian Flynn writes in her novel Gone Girl, telling a public who gawked through the O.J. Simpson and Scott Peterson trials what they already know. Flynn's novel, along with David Fincher's 2014 movie adaptation, is the subversive American noir of the court TV era. It features two remarkably odious narrators. Amy Dunn is cruel, self-important, and vindictive as she meticulously frames her husband for her own murder to punish him for cheating on her. Her husband, Nick Dunn, is self-pitying and self-deluded. Told by these two exaggerated voices, the story is a pulpy, shameless thriller, theatrical in its every element, including its self-conscious interest in true crime television and the trope that spawned its premise, that a woman's husband is always the most logical suspect in her murder. Amy watches shows about police procedure and reads true crime books to plan her stunt, luring Nick into doing classically suspicious things like taking out a life insurance policy on her. Gone Girl depicts the true crime obsession as a feedback loop. Serial killers watch the same shows we do, one of the detectives says, and Amy sees in them a chance to transfigure herself. She becomes the author of her own narrative, where she was the hero, flawless and adored, because everyone loves the dead girl. What else could she gather from TV's proliferation of real-life murder stories? Beginning with news magazine shows like 2020 and 48 Hours, with Court TV, originally a C-SPAN for salacious 90s court cases, which became popular during the trials of the Menendez brothers and O.J. Simpson, true crime TV is now reaching its gleeful, febrile, shameless apex. Reborn in 2008, the cable network Investigation Discovery is now all murder all the time. A sample of its programming, Beauty Queen Murders, Catch My Killer, Deadly Devotion, Motives in Murders, Nightmare Next Door, Killer Clergy, Unusual Suspects, and Wives with Knives. If you watch enough hours of murder shows, you experience a peculiar sense of deja vu. Despite what would seem to be a wellspring of new cases, the same murders are recounted again and again across shows, migrating through Investigation Discovery programming blocks. The story of Florida airline gate agent Karen Pinnell, who was murdered by her ex-boyfriend Timothy Permenter in 2003, has been on Dateline, Forensic Files, and the Investigation Discovery original program Solved. The most memorable fact of the case is that Permenter wrote Rock, the name of another of Pinnell's exes, in her blood on the wall above her body, lamely attempting to forge a dying declaration. This detail gives the story the feel of a whodunit. On Dateline, Forensic Files, and Solved, detectives emphasize the gruesome glamour of this clue, all saying in their interviews variations of, it's like something out of the movies. It's a clue that announces itself, like the ones in Amy's sinister scavenger hunt in Gone Girl that led Nick and the police to all the evidence she has planted. Amy orchestrates a truly grotesque melodrama, and still I find her more sympathetic than Nick, who is so convinced that he has tried at every moment to do the right thing. His father was an abusive misogynist, but Nick says, I've tried all my life to be a decent guy, a man who loved and respected women, a man without hang-ups. When his issues with women do leak through, like when he becomes momentarily furious that a female detective is telling him what to do in his own home, he blames it on being raised by his father and thinks his self-awareness will absolve him. He's the classic male victim. Even his misogyny is something that was done to him. This is why Nix is the more damning characterization. Because Amy bears no resemblance to any person who has ever walked the planet, but she bears a resemblance to women as conceived of in the nightmares of men like Nick, and there are many of those men walking the planet. For decent guys, comfortably vested with patriarchal authority, the nightmare is merely to be questioned, to no longer be the narrator of their own story. In Gone Girl, Flynn cracks open the American mainstream and lets Nick say one of our unsayable beliefs. That it is scarier for a man to be accused than to be killed.
Well, thank you so much. We're a podcast who loves, you know, we especially favor writers from Kansas City, Maryland, Minnesota, and Sri Lanka. And Gillian Flynn, being a Kansas City writer and a friend, I love the way that you write about her work. But I'm really struck in that essay by the line, in that passage by the line, the nightmare is merely to be questions, to no longer be the narrator of their own story. You know, I kept thinking about, look, we're recording this not long after Trump's press conference in Helsinki with Putin, and the way that he handled the questions and the questions about the Mueller indictments and American intelligence reports on Russian interference in the elections, his inability to admit like basic facts because they question his narrative of how he won the election, seems like he's the perfect kind of example of someone who's invested in patriarchal authority that you're talking about here.
I mean, yeah, absolutely. I think it's pretty obvious that the number one thing Trump doesn't want is to be questioned or criticized or to have to apologize or take something back. I mean, he says he's never apologized. When I think about that story and that passage or my kind of reading of Gone Girl, I think about Me Too so much because it is about allowing women to tell their own stories or believing women. But it's also about a broader pattern of behavior of powerful men. I mean, clearly these two things are related. I mean, obviously in the figure of Donald Trump, they're related, but also this fear of being accused or of being, railroaded by angry women is so much a part of our narrative of Me Too. It's hilarious. I mean, other than that, it's horrible where it feels like women are told you should expect to be threatened or you should expect to fear sexual harassment, where men should not have to expect or to fear any kind of harassment. It's like obvious that one kind of threat is preferable to the other.
And men shouldn't have to feel bad ever.
Right.
Is another thing that I think is coming up in your writing about these types of stories, and with Nick Dunn as an example, like the most horrible thing for him is to have to feel bad or just to be questioned.
Right. That those feelings of guilt or shame could come up is the real trespass in the story.
Right. So women have to offer sort of all of this proof before they're believed, 60 Cosby accusations or whatever before those women are believed. And then if a man is not believed on the strength of his own word, it's sort of intolerable and offensive. I was thinking of that Margaret Atwood. I think it's Margaret Atwood. The women are afraid that men will kill them, and men are afraid women will laugh at them, or maybe it's the other way around. And the other night I took a Lyft and I was with a friend, we got in the car, and the driver sort of immediately said something inappropriate. And then we both sort of sat there stunned, and he turned around and looked at us and said, do you understand English? And my friend, who was much more composed than me, said, I understood what you said. I didn't understand why you said it. And then I think he realized he had said something inappropriate. He drove us and, dropped her off at one spot and then dropped me off at another. And sort of as I got down, said 5 stars for you, which was very clearly a plea that I rate him highly. Mm-hmm. And I realized that he had been driving since saying that with this fear that I was going to rate him down. And as I walked towards my destination, I had somehow invented this whole narrative that he was going to follow me.
Yeah.
Which was it was not actually the least plausible narrative. I don't think it was super likely, but that sort of the whole fiction of, or the whole possibility of him committing some sort of violence against me out of fear, out of anger at our reaction to him was really present in my mind. I wasn't actually thinking at all about how I was going to rate him. And
it's almost like getting encoded. That's like an encoding from the Dead Woman Show narrative, do you think? Okay.
I mean, in my opinion, that's one reason. I mean, I feel like my feelings about detective narratives and dead girl narratives are not, I mean, they are nuanced, but I also feel like one of the main reasons that I'm uncomfortable with the prevalence of these narratives is because I feel like they teach women to behave in a certain way. They teach women to be afraid, and they ultimately police women's behavior, where it's like, don't be like that. Or that some many people would think that Sugi's fear was just smart. Like, oh, well, you were just being smart. You're just looking out for yourself. Like that fear is something that she should have to expect, or that's just collateral damage for being a woman in the world. I don't feel like that fear is something we should have to expect. I feel like that fear is something we should be free of. And I think that if that expectation of violence, if our culture were more humane and more ethical and more fair, then that fear maybe is something we could let go of.
Yeah, I mean, since I've read your book, I've been thinking about my own consumption of a lot of these types of stories, and the things that they've been, the narratives that they've enforced upon me, just like in, like, I really relate to what Sugi was saying, her example. And I've been thinking as I've been, you know, approaching new true crime and other things about a spin on the Bechdel test, which would be the Bolin test, wherein true crime or crime fiction somehow avoids the dead girl trope that you outline in these essays, or doesn't just produce the worst parts of these narratives. And it seems like there are a couple of things you talk about in the book that do pass the Bolin test, like in Gone Girl, just from the part that you've just read, Amy Dunn manipulates the concept of the dead girl to control her own narrative. And you also mention other shows and books like Pretty Little Liars and Jess Walter's Over Tumbled Graves. So what have you encountered recently that manages to like get over the Bolin test? And how would you describe like what the Bolin test would be?
I mean, it's such a funny thing because I had a friend who said the same thing. Oh, there should be a Bolin test like the Bechdel test for dead girl stories. And she was saying, oh, I'm worried that I wrote a dead girl story. And I think the thing about the Bechdel test is that I don't think that Alison Bechdel encourages everyone to have exactly two female characters and have them have one conversation. Yeah. You know, I think her point is that it's a very low bar. It's a very low threshold. And most... still so many movies and books don't cross it. And it's sort of the point is how insanely hostile to women's stories our popular media is. And so I think for me, my desire is not for people to just say, okay, so we have managed to, you know, squeak by, by maybe yeah. having a male victim instead, or by, you know, maybe making the detective a woman. It's not that I don't think those stories are interesting, but I think that we can have more imagination about the kind of stories that we tell. I think we're so obsessed with being self-referential or being referential in general. And that's one reason that we reproduce these stories, because a story like Twin Peaks is so iconic that people think, oh, I want to play with that idea, or I want to do my version of it. And I feel like we need to sort of think outside of that frame, especially within movies and TV, to be thinking about how we could tell completely new stories, while also myself wrestling with this, you know, love of true crime and pulp storytelling and love of the ways that those stories are, you know, recreated. So of course I have mixed feelings in general. I mean, it's funny because we're like Megan Abbott, she just had her book come out yesterday, I guess, or her new book, Give Me Your Hand. And she gave an interview where she was sort of saying, we need dead girl stories. I want to play with stories that, you know, think about female anger and about violence. And that thinking about that dead girl character is how we'll kind of get to the bottom of, that obsession. And I don't think she's wrong. And I think that she's a very skilled and wonderful writer and very provocative. And so I think there's multiple kind of ways in to shaping, you know, our attitudes towards women in popular culture. I think the main thing is allowing women to tell their own stories, having a more diversity of voices, and, you know, challenging ourselves not just to reproduce the same stories over and over again, but to think about new kinds of narratives.
I was thinking, at least my understanding from when I was reading your book is that one of the issues isn't just the fact of a female character being killed in the course of a book, but that character is never allowed to be a character. In other right. words, to have an arc. They begin as dead, right? And they're dead purely to motivate usually the male detective to go off on a quest. Just, you know, is that the part of the trope that is the, you know, like, in other words, is that part of it? You know,
it's one part of it. I mean, I think that the fact is that when you watch a dead girl show in general, you're not saying, oh, I so relate to that corpse. You know, you relate to the, I think in general, the viewer relates to the figure of the detective who's solving the crime.
Right.
Where if we were to relate to the victim, those stories would be too painful and too grotesque. It kind of needs to be this set piece, like this empty corpse. I always think actually about In Cold Blood, about the ways that he sets up the kind of mundanity of the Clutters' lives and their each individual character, all the, you know, their humanity is set up in that first section of the book. So when they're horrifically and senselessly murdered, you really feel a sense of shock. I always think of that as this sort of example of a way where we really feel empathy for victims in a way that's almost, well, that's very interesting because he calls it a nonfiction novel, but probably no novelist would ever do that, you know?
Yeah.
That's one way in which that narrative to me is quite unique.
When I was thinking about books that I've loved for a long time, I was thinking about A Time to Kill, which I think I probably read after The Firm came out, and how I read the beginning of that book and expected the little girl who is sexually assaulted at the beginning of that book, I expected her to die. And like one of the very interesting kind of things about that book is that she doesn't, and that it isn't really about whether the crime was committed, but it sort of becomes about what happens to her family and about the law. Or I was thinking about Barb in Stranger Things, Sophie Mole in The God of Small Things, Everything I Never Told You by Celeste Ng, which does sort of, there are writers who resurrect characters after telling us that they'll die, or without sort of having too many spoiler alerts for Celeste's book, although I suspect many, many people have read it already, obviously, or Leslie Arima's short story collection, where she does a lot of interesting things with women characters who have awful things happen to them, but then does give them that space to be characters. So I feel like some of the ways I've seen people play with this, when the girl survives and we don't expect it, or also I felt like with Stranger Things, I kind of expected that mystery to resolve in some way that redeemed people, and instead it sort of just stuck.
Right. In the essay that I wrote about your book, Alice, I was thinking a lot about The Lovely Bones.
Right.
And how in that book, Alice Siebold's novel, how the girl dies in the first couple of pages, but she narrates the whole book. We're with her in her weird heaven where she's still, you know, seeing what happens to her family and everyone in her town after she dies.
I think there is something, well, I actually talked to my friend Alyssa Washuda, the nonfiction writer, about this, where I feel like there's a space in books and in literature, maybe to have that kind of empathetic connection with characters that so far we haven't seen as much in movies or TV, I think the Barb example is an interesting one of a character who's so beloved, not really getting her chance at redemption. And you do kind of feel that. It's not just like, it's not purely exploitive.
Well, I think people were so excited about, I mean, I think Susie Salmon is such a great example from The Lovely Bones. I mean, I remember that point of view choice kind of creating huge waves when that book came out. And of course, Alice Siebold's memoir touching on similar material. And with Stranger Things and with Barb, people were so attached to Barb because she didn't fit the trope of sort of, I mean, she struck people as a very butch character. The portrayal of her friendship with Nancy Wheeler, like that demonstration of female friendship as a thing that was lost with death, rather than just sort of straight intimacy, but sort of friendship as and perhaps female desire or queer desire as something that was collapsing with this crime, and then also the criminal being something larger than any individual.
Yeah.
That was such an interesting way to play that.
That is interesting. I never actually thought of Barb in that way. And I also think, I mean, I think it's interesting you bring up Alice Siebold's memoir, because I feel like memoir is a place of an interesting ways where survivors get to tell their own stories. Often the survivors kind of confronting their audience with material that's maybe difficult to read about, hard to hear. And it's kind of like, I mean, I think in some ways we are kind of relieved by the dead girl because we don't have to hear about what she's gone through, or we don't see that in first person because those crimes are so horrific. And actually having to read from the person's mouth a survivor narrative often kind of takes that, the kind of taste for a crime narrative, out of your mouth. I don't know if that's the right way to say it, but it kind of kills any titillation that you might get from a crime narrative to actually hear it directly from the survivor.
I had, in my very first novel, The Huntsman has a female character who is killed, and the idea came to me from a sort of like really early Me Too thing, which was that I had gone to school with a young woman who, after college and when he had grown older, she came back to Kansas City, had a press conference and said that her father, who was a prominent member of the community, had sexually abused her ever since she was a kid. Oh, and wow. People did not believe her, you know.
Oh, God.
It just caused this incredible uproar. And so I wanted a way to sort of try to voice that within a story. And so she's a character in most of the book. I mean, the book has a huge, long flashback that's basically the entire middle part of the book, and it's sort of her story and a lot of other stories. But it was an interesting way of you know, I just thought of that as being like an early... I wouldn't want to not have that story in the book. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it seems like such a fascinating and fraught moment for that community, and it sounds like they really reacted incorrectly.
Oh my God. It was a disaster. Yes.
But yeah, I mean, those are the kinds of stories where once you have that reckoning, how do you move on? I mean, that's the subject of most novels, you know, but we are thinking in these kind of dark terms.
Yeah, I think it's about agency, really. You know, you're talking about refusing to let that character have any agency. They're just acted upon.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And I think that I feel like we just need to keep pushing it. I mean, it's like I'm not the police. I'm not the story police. But when I think about writing about female characters or about crime and violence or even just like period, I want us to move beyond kind of archetypes, even though they're so fun to play with. I mean, that's what I think about a show like Stranger Things, where I'm like, the reason I don't really get excited about that show is because I'm sort of like, okay, this show is self-conscious. This show is full of illusions, but what else have you got for me? Like, what else are we playing with here? And I'm not really like, for me, it's not that much. For lots of people love that show, so I'm not really trying to start a fight at all, but,
it's one of the moments when I really wish that our show could have a call-in section.
Right. Yeah, people get mad and call in. But I mean, in general, I feel like that's my problem, where I find genre fiction so fascinating and genre stuff in general so fascinating and fun to write about and fun to engage with, but also obviously frustrating for those reasons that often the tropes are kind of just there because they're fun.
What do you think about how popular true crime and dead girls are with women? It seems counterintuitive that we would be so interested in hearing about terrible things happening to women, but My Favorite Murder is hosted by women. And there are all of these writers who are women who are kind of seizing control of some of these narratives and who have been very popular storytellers in this vein.
Well, I think it's two things where I think often people talk about how women are drawn to true crime and to crime narratives in general because it kind of validates that feeling, like you were talking about, that feeling of being threatened or being afraid of violence. You're kind of told, yeah, by these stories, they tell you, yeah, you should be afraid, or like those fears are valid, or those experiences of violence that you know, whatever, 3 out of 5 women have, you identify with that victim on screen. Even like my friend Alyssa, who I was just talking about, she has an essay in her book, My Body is a Book of Rules, where she writes about being, I mean, the book is about bipolar disorder and it's about being a victim of sexual violence. And she talks about becoming obsessed with Law and Order SVU and using it as a way to think about her own rape, because she was saying she never reported her rape. She never interacted with cops. And she kind of plays out these scenarios where she has the good cop or the bad cop, the cop who believes her or the cop who doesn't. And that show helps her to think about that experience. But I also think there are a lot of ways where, I mean, I don't know, just to be provocative, where I feel like My Favorite Murder, for example, even though these are progressive white women, I think they enforce a lot of really conservative ideas about law enforcement, about incarceration, even about the death penalty, about psychopathy and psychology, in the name of protecting female victims, often white female victims. They're really regurgitating a lot of these ideas that I personally find troubling, or I don't consider particularly progressive. So I think in some ways it is a realm where some of these authoritarian beliefs kind of manifest themselves and kind of in the name of sort of personal fear or protection. So I feel like that's one reason that even though I think My Favorite Murder is funny and sort of I get why people like it, I also think we do still have to question those things that we're drawn to, because I feel like quite often it is about wanting to retreat to some of these really conservative beliefs for people who consider themselves very liberal.
And even with My Favorite Murder, I think that a lot of it is reinforcing like policing of women, even though they're saying they're not, with the whole stay sexy and don't get murdered.
Pepper spray first, ask questions later. That's
exactly
one thing they say.
Yeah. So it's like always be on guard. Don't be polite, all of these things.
Oh, come the cops right now.
Yeah, the popo is coming. I feel like I make a connection to those impulses where they're saying, call the cops, don't apologize, to, you know, all of these stories we hear about Black people having the police called on them for just, you know, sitting or, you know, being in their own front lawn. It's not that far of a risk to tell. I mean, it's not that far of a jump if you're telling women, if you feel afraid, if you feel even slightly threatened, you know, pepper spray first. That doesn't really like get to the heart of the problem, or it doesn't really solve anything. And actually, it maybe reinforces some of these hierarchies.
Well, that's one of the things, some of those ideas
about white femininity.
Yeah. Yeah. That's one of the things we talked about with Matt in the earlier show that Sugi was mentioning. And by the way, I just want to say we're going to link to Kristen's essay and we'll link to the essays that you're mentioning by Alyssa and everyone else in our reading sections. You can find it on our show page at LitHub. You know, one of the things we talked about with Matt is the way that, you know, the emphasis on the story always being told from the detective's point of view is a way, an emphasis on, you know, sort of an advertisement for the police state, you know?
I mean,
you know, what was the show that was all about forensics?
Forensic Files.
No. Yeah. The other one that was like...
CSI?
Yeah, CSI, the one where they played The Who at the beginning. Like, that show was so much... I felt like that show had been, like, ordered up by the NSA to be put on television
so that you
would be okay with the stuff that was going to be happening with the Patriot Act after 9/11, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And, I mean, I think that is... those kind of stories are kind of... you know, societal programming, especially, yeah, these stories that enforce fear or talk about our fears.
So you were just, the one thing I want to mention here is also most of the time, you know, we're talking about a young white woman who's at the center of a dead girl story. And Alice, you point in your book, and Kristen, you talk about this in your LitHub piece also, that white women are the least at risk when looking at statistics on murdered women, if I'm right about that. So
yeah.
What's going on here? And why do you think, is there some way that white women benefit from this archetype that we're discussing?
I mean, I think, of course, they benefit, or we benefit in terms of, you know, meriting more protection or, you know, more care and value. But I think also there's something to this feeling, like this desire for a mystery. So if we have the perfect victim, who's this beautiful young white woman, and we solve her murder, then everything is right with the world. Where if we actually face who is actually quite often the victim of murders or violent crimes, then we have to think a little bit more broadly and with more empathy towards people who we don't really want to feel empathy towards, which is often, you know, marginalized groups, women of color, people of color, trans people. I think that having that character as sort of the only person we have to feel empathy for helps us to not examine the broader structural problems that lead to crime.
So your book covers a lot more, of course, than Dead Girls. You talk about moving to L.A. after growing up in rural Idaho, pop culture, etc. You spend time analyzing Britney Spears' lyrics, perhaps, quote unquote, overthinking, and discuss her very public fall from grace along with other celebrities like Miley Cyrus and Alexis Nairs, famous for her role in The Bling Ring. So why do those figures fit in with this collection?
I feel like most of the people on Goodreads probably are annoyed that all of those other things are in the collection. They probably pretty much just want it to be all dead girls all the time. And that was pretty much exactly what I didn't want to do with this book was, I mean, obviously there are a million dead girls. There are more all the time. But I wanted to think about the broader kind of context of that trope or that image in our culture, and what, I don't know, other kinds of pop cultural things that are maybe complementary. I always think of Britney Spears and the ways that she especially was so fetishized and so, you know, hounded by the paparazzi, the ways her pain was, you know, commodified is so dehumanizing. And I think that has a lot in common with the ways that a dead girl body on SVU is sort of fetishized or dehumanized. But at the same time, a lot of this book is, you know, memoir, and it's a lot about my experiences. And so I'm really thinking about the ways that my interaction with pop culture and my, you know, pop culture obsession informed, you know, my so-called real life.
I love the way that you talked about your dad through his interest in Norwegian or Icelandic crime fiction.
Yeah, Swedish. Okay. Mostly Swedish noirs, but yeah, that's one thing where it kind of was later in the process where it's like, oh, why am I obsessed with dead girls? Maybe it's because my dad had these like dead girl books all around my house, you know, all my whole childhood. The ways that my personal connection to these things is part of the narrative of the book, or mostly the narrative of the book, and not just my criticism or my analysis that maybe is sort of beside the point in the end.
So back in May, you tweeted, "I wrote a book about how the constant fear of being murdered by men constrains women's freedom and about our giddy obsession with real life and fictional murder stories. It was a quixotic attempt to change this aspect of our culture, and I truly find it exhausting how topical it is. What are some of the things that you hoped your book would change about how we see dead girls?"
I mean, I really thought when my Dead Girl Show essay was published that there wouldn't be a second season of True Detective. Like, that's how full of myself I was. I was like, I have really dropped the mic on this one, and everyone's going to stop making Dead Girl shows, and I'm really have changed the world. Like, of course not. Like, it only has gotten, you know, more and more of these stories. So, I mean, in some, like, ambitious ways, I do hope that makers in Hollywood and writers, you know, sitting at their desks, think harder about the kinds of stories that they tell and don't just, you know, regurgitate these stories because they're stylish or because they're fun, but sort of try to come up with something new, but sort of more humbly or like more on the realistic side. I'm just really hoping that people will engage more thoughtfully with the stories that we choose to consume. I mean, a lot of the book is about this obsession with narrative in general and our obsession with stories and with consuming more and more stories all the time. And obviously, you know, I'm a teller of stories. That's my whole job and my whole livelihood. But in some ways, our obsession with a good story is really not that productive. You know, it becomes kind of mercenary, or it becomes sort of amoral. And I hope that we can just like have slightly more. Well, let me think. Let me go back.
Well, I think there's a difference between a good story and a lazy story. And I think sometimes people mistake a lazy story for a comforting story. Do you know what I mean? Is that, in other words, like sometimes people want or think they want a lazy story, but really what you're talking about is sort of asking like, well, why is it? I mean, the thing that I really care that made me want to write about the woman that I was mentioning before that I patterned this character for in my first novel was that she actually, instead of like having some detective go out and like solve her problem for her or solve her murder, she like confronted the society and her victimizer, right, in public,
right,
and did it. It didn't turn out great, but she did it, you know? And why?
Right.
And the dead girl never gets to do that in the trope, right?
I mean, in a way, you feel like that's not a good story. You know, I mean, it's an interesting story, but it's not
overly
satisfying.
It's a good story. I like that story.
What I mean is it's not that satisfying in a way, or maybe it's satisfying in a certain, like, Aaron Brockovich kind of way, but it's uncomfortable at the same time.
She didn't win.
Right. That story is not the one that the reader, you know, necessarily wants,
right,
so to speak.
Oh, I
and
totally
so kind
agree
of,
with that.
You know, so even though, yes, of course, it's, you know, a fascinating story, often we need to play more to those kind of impulses that challenge the audience as writers, but also as audiences to seek out those stories that challenge us a little bit more, but also just to take a second, you know, to be more critical, to maybe overthink from time to time and have those conversations instead of just sort of letting TV and stories narcotize us and, you know, just let fan culture be so seductive. I really do want to get to a place of more critical discourse about our popular genres.
For me, and this may not be popular with my fellow writers, is why I think literary critics and pop culture critics are very important, and we don't have enough of them these days. We need more. So we've really...
I would say we need not even necessarily more of them, but... And this is going to be maybe even less popular. I think we need them to be better.
Well, yeah. Okay.
Well, I think that we need the... I think we have a lot of good critics who are not really given a lot of good opportunities.
Yeah, that's true as well.
I mean, necessarily, where for me, I always wanted to write a book and I always knew I wanted it to be, you know, to have criticism in it. But I think, and so I then waited tables and, you know, now I have this teaching job at the University of Memphis. But for writers who want to make a living freelancing, you're not going to do that by writing, you know, long, thoughtful pieces about obscure corners of pop culture. Some people have done it, but usually you're going to be writing takes that are super quick and not overly well researched by and large. So I think that, yeah, it's about maybe having, I mean, I don't even know. I feel like that's a straw man too, because there are so many great writers, but having more opportunities for a more sort of cold take economy instead of everything being these quick, short reviews.
I think that's really well put, because I think that when I say I want the criticism to be better, I guess it seems to me like so much, and I mean, some of this is quite well documented, right? That books by women and by people from other marginalized identities are reviewed less. And mm-hmm. I think like quite a lot of us would probably say, like, kind of anecdotally, and there's probably some data on this too, that those, I mean, the kinds of conversations that we have about those books are sometimes, they're not as deep. And I don't know what's preventing that kind of rigor, or I do know what's preventing that kind of rigor, and I hate it. It would take a separate episode.
But like, right.
I mean, so when the stories are about women, I would assume that some of the same things pertain. And like, it's really awesome, I think, that that your book and Kristen's essay are kind of prompting a more inventive conversation about these stories, not saying necessarily that we should turn away from them, but saying to like look differently, to look harder. And I'm really interested in what you said about encouraging readers to be more introspective, because I think that something that has really slipped over the past, I feel like maybe since I was a kid, is that I'm not sure that readers are reading as thoughtfully as they once did. There's this surfeit of other information. You know, would you rather read about the author? Would you rather read the book itself? And I'm eager and interested in ways to challenge readers. So,
well, especially because people are consumers, you know, and everything, you know, an Amazon review or a Goodreads review is a yes or a no. Not to say that there aren't thoughtful people reviewing on those sites, but often it's about being like, I didn't like this and here's why, or I did like this and here's why. And it's really a consumer guide. It's not really a conversation. So I feel like, you know, those books that don't play to consumers often kind of fall by the wayside.
And those are the books that we hope to talk about on this podcast.
Well, that's why I made a joke on Twitter, like my book should be called Book Reviews No One Asked For, where it's all books that you know, nobody really wanted to talk to me about, like Over Tumbled Graves by Jess Walter, his forgotten first novel. So I was like, I'm definitely having a long essay in my book about that.
Well, Jess has been on the show. We love him. He's a good friend as well. So look, we're so happy to have Alice, both you and Kristen, on the show. We really appreciate the writing. Kristen, we loved your essay, and Alice, we've loved looking at the book. So thank you so much for being here.
Thank you guys so much. This was awesome.
Yeah, thanks for having us. This was so much fun.
And thank you so much for joining us. This has been a great episode, great conversation.
That's it for the Fiction Nonfiction Podcast. Our theme music is composed by Travis Workman. I'm Aaron Saxon, an intern producer for the podcast, along with Kevin Coder. You can subscribe to us by typing fiction/non/fiction into the search bar of your favorite podcast app. You can also listen, find previous episodes, and read excerpts from our interviews at the Literary Hub website, lithub.com, where the Fiction Nonfiction Podcast page is listed under the News tab. We'll post a link to the books we referenced this week on our LitHub show page on Facebook at FNFPod, and on Twitter at FNF Talk. Kevin Coder and I are MFA candidates at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Speaking of UMKC and Dead Girls, You should check out UMKC alum Emily Gemender's new short story collection from Dezank Books, also called Dead Girls. Happy reading.